Okay, so hello everyone. We're really happy to have Gord back, who is a trucker and a writer and an active media commentator on trucking issues and labor issues more broadly. We had him on the show a few months ago to give us his view of the trucker protest that was going on in Ottawa. So that's kind of wrapped up, and but Gord has stayed active. So how are you doing, Gord? How are you feeling post-trucker protest?
I'm well. I don't know how active is a bit of a loaded term. I mean,
Oh.
active insofar as one can be once you've been booted from Twitter again. And I mean, yeah, I'm watching a lot from the sidelines, but since the Freedom Convoy, I switched and got a different job, and I've been working a lot of hours, and life goes on. I have two small children, all the rest of that. But yeah, I've published a couple more pieces here and there, and I've been trying to very unsuccessfully wage the info war for this particular bill before Congress in the US that appears to be going nowhere, that's supposed to help truck drivers with the money side of things. Yeah, I've got a couple other little projects in the background I'm not going to elaborate on too much here in case they don't come out. But yeah, there's going to be more written things coming later in the summer.
That's awesome. Yeah. I just meant like active as a writer and, active in the political sphere. There's nothing wrong with
Sure. Well, I mean,
that.
Unfortunately, the political sphere is where certain things do get done, and sometimes it takes legislation and or serious cajoling to make certain things happen. And yeah, like I said, there's this one bill in Congress. It's called the Guaranteed Overtime for Truckers Act. Well, one of the things many people don't know is that most truck drivers are not entitled to overtime pay. In the United States, it's because of an exception granted under the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act. And Canada has something similar. Australia, same. Most Western countries, there's unless you work for a generous employer or you're part of the Teamsters Union or something, there's not really any overtime. And you get most truck drivers are paid by the mile anyway, like the long distance guys. But a lot of the hourly local guys don't get it either. So.
Okay, well, before jumping into your work with this bill, which is really important, you've got a few pieces kind of come out in the last couple of months. So to begin with, you had a really interesting, well, you had this Newsweek article published, which has to do with the bill that you're referring to. But this was following an in-person interview you did with a journalist who joined you as you were working, as you were trucking. So how did that experience go? Like, I know that it was as a result of your work with the truckers protest, and she reached out to you to do that.
Yeah, so it's actually an editor at a place I write has been asked by her publishers to write another book, and seeing as how her modus operandi is trying to give voice to the working class as of late, she decided she's gonna do in-depth interviews with a few people she knows, and one of them was me. So she came trucking with me for a day. I have a long history of like picking up hitchhikers and taking my friends and family and stuff trucking with me, so it was not too big of a deal. It was actually good. We got to like chat quite a bit, and she's never been in a big rig before, so that was she got to see life from my commanding view of the road. And fair play to her, did the hard yards, got out of bed at 4 in the morning, came trucking with me all day, and managed to stay awake through it all and thoroughly entertained. So yeah, it was good.
That's great. So you were just talking about a bill that you're looking to promote and you've been trying to promote, which is the Guaranteeing Overtime for Truckers Act, which was introduced in April in Congress by Representative Levine. So he is a Democratic representative in Congress. So I guess to start out our discussion about this bill, can you tell us why you think that this is being introduced at this point, and what are the main items of the bill that are you that you hope Congress will approve?
So the bill is pretty straightforward. It removes this exemption from the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act that says, people working in transportation are exempted from guaranteed overtime after 40 hours. That's it. That's the entirety of the bill. When I first wrote the piece, you know, you're not supposed to read the comment sections on things because, you know, unfortunately, some people don't read and or are just antagonistic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got the whole like, oh, this is a Democrat. It's probably full like rich giveaways for their corporate buddies, or it's probably tacked onto a budget bill, or the Republicans would say, you know, like conservative types would say, say that. And then, you know, Democrat types would say, oh, yeah, well, yeah, good luck getting that with the Republicans. They don't care. And it was just typical partisan nonsense. But, like, the bill is literally one line. It's a standalone bill. It's not part of any other bill. It's not hooked up to anything else.
Yep.
I cannot speak to the motivations of Representative Levin. I did do, like, an email interview with his press secretary, a lady by the name of Janai Washington.
Yep.
And we had a back and forth. And I think she basically gave me, like, a sort of stock standard, because I asked her the same thing, you know, like, what lit a fire under Representative DeLevin to care about us? And she just said that, you know, he's watched the supply chain issues and, like, how hard truckers worked, and then discovered that they didn't get paid overtime, and he just felt compelled to do it. And, I mean, I got to take her at her word.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you go through this guy's Twitter account, and he's basically a bog standard identity politics hustling Democrat that I would probably never support on 90% of the other stuff he might be involved in. But, you know, hey, if he's going to do something for my people, then hey, good, let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, who knows, like, politicians do things sometimes out of principle, for sure, even today,
it does happen, and typically those bills usually don't get anywhere.
yeah, who knows, like, it could be something that he's trying to do just to bolster his credentials or his appearance, his brand, I guess. But
it's very interesting, because there's been this, like, you know, there's been a lot of discussion out in the zeitgeist, especially on political Twitter, and especially amongst, like, you know, the populist types and whatnot, is that the Democrats have basically abandoned the working class. Like, basically ever since Bill Clinton sold us all out with NAFTA and going along with the jobs getting shipped to China and all that stuff, and then the introduction of identity politics into the mix, and, you know, all these weird social issues or vanity issues, you know, that lots of people in the Democratic Party support. So it's sort of weird in this particular moment to see one of them actually do something for, like, a particular demographic that's not necessarily part of the Democratic Party coalition anymore. I mean, truckers are overwhelmingly sort of lean conservative. Or at least populist or apolitical.
Yep.
There's not very many of them that are members of the Democratic Party anymore. And so for Levin to do this, it looks a little strange, like, looking at it from a political angle.
Yeah, a lot of the political theories that I'm familiar with are kind of failing to draw up an explanation for it. But it's all the better. I'm happy he's championing the bill. It seems like it's a really unfair arrangement that trucking is this one industry that doesn't qualify for overtime pay. It just means that you're working for free. So,
yeah. Well, and I mean, there's, you know, lots of people like to say, well, you know, you guys get paid by the mile and it's piecework and that comes with the territory. But I'm like, you know, you can get a calculator out and you can prorate that piecework and then divide it by time and figure this stuff out. And, you know, one of the things that Levin did mention, and that's true, is, you know, we have all these supply chain problems.
Yes.
And, I mean, there's always been this, like, issue in trucking about, like, a driver shortage, which is, like, true sometimes and not true most of the time. And it can be lane or industry specific. Like, my one boss that I used to work for in Canada I was speaking with recently, he said he's got 20 trucks sitting because he can't find anybody to drive them. So, I mean, the truck driver shortage is real for him.
Yeah.
But, like, in the United States, there's a gazillion people with CDLs. They've just decided not to work in the business because they get screwed all the time. One of the things they get screwed by is not having overtime. And so Levin's bill is can sort of be viewed as like trying to fix that part of the supply chain issue up and get people to actually work. And one of I spoke with another like trucking related podcast a couple of weeks ago about this, and one of the ways in which I think the trucking industry could use this bill, like instead of being afraid of it and saying, you know, this is going to cost us too much, we can't afford to actually pay you guys the value for your time, you know, we won't be able to pass this cost along to our customers. And like, okay, fine, let's take that for granted, even though I disagree. We could use it as leverage, right? Because a lot of the supply chain stuff and a lot of issues, a reason that truck drivers don't like hanging around the business is because their time gets screwed all the time, especially loading and unloading. So you like roll into some joint, you have an appointment, you get there on time, and then, you know, 3-4 hours later they start unloading you, maybe 8 hours, maybe a day. The delays in the business, what we call detention, is pretty bad in certain segments of the freight and refrigerated markets. So if there was a cost attached to all this time, then it would sort of force these companies to have to pay more. And then if trucking companies had that leverage, they could say, well, you know, if you actually got the trucks moving, we wouldn't have to charge you so much, because then we wouldn't have, our drivers wouldn't be going over 40 hours a week all the time, because a lot of truck drivers' hours is just sitting around waiting, burning up at docks, because the logistics and supply chain industry, such as it's been basically forever, just don't value drivers' time, and they don't have enough personnel to load trucks. They are not typically organized very well, and guys just end up eating that disorganization and lack of labor at facilities. And so if this bill forces an overtime pay to drivers, then that means, you know, shippers are going to have to pay more. And they could use this bill to say, well, you know, you could avoid paying that extra if you actually got our trucks moving, which I think is a good idea.
You are kind of laying out a good business case for it too. It's not just about trucker welfare.
No, yeah. not just that, but yeah, actually keeping the supply chain moving efficiently instead of having all this capacity sitting around wasting time.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned in your article, speaking of the business side, you do mention in your article that many firms will be affected by this change, that will be affected by this change, are claiming that they cannot afford to pay truckers overtime. So what do you make of that kind of statement?
I think for many firms that's true, and for many firms it's not. Depends on, again, the freight you're hauling, the relationship with your customers. But yeah, generally speaking, hauling freight, like general freight and van trailers, the profit margins are super skinny. And I do sort of understand the owners of these companies going like, we can't afford this. Well, it's like, well, you got to pass the cost along, right? Now there's a good question to be asked about how much can the wider economy afford cost increases like that. And I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but like, again, if you think about this creatively and use this legislation as leverage to say, hey, we might experience more efficiencies and cost savings if you get the trucks moving, and if it takes the threat of paying drivers overtime in order to get you guys to pull your thumbs out of your asses and have the system work better, well, then so be it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there is a potential cost increase that would, I suppose, eventually end up in the hands of the consumer. But if you were to make supply chains more efficient, then you could avoid that. So this could be a motivating factor.
Sure, that's the reason I would support this, because I think you can do all of that, and then the cost across the rest of the economy, it would be a wash if they actually leveled it out by being more efficient under threat of having to actually pay overtime.
Yeah. So in your piece, you also say you have a comment about the Republicans who did not originate this bill. There is a co-sponsor that's a Republican, Jeff Van Drew of New York, who's now
New Jersey. Jefferson Van Drew from New Jersey. Yep.
New Jersey. Thank you. So you say, you know, will Republicans, many of whom have taken to calling themselves the party of the working class, support us truckers and vote for this bill. So what are your thoughts on that now that you've the bill has gotten a Republican co-sponsor? Do you think it will get some significant Republican support?
Well, the support, I don't know if it's going to get any in Congress. It needs it in the Senate. The people I've spoken with around Representative Levin, and I've spoken with someone who's helping him with the bill and working in the background, who shall remain nameless. They believe they have no trouble getting it through the House. It's getting it through the Senate. And so that's why I aimed my comments in the article at a handful of senators, specifically Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Josh Hawley, and Rand Paul. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of them, you know, all politicians make noise about, you know, good paying American jobs. And then what happens? Where's the good paying American jobs? It's usually just noise. And here's a bill that will dramatically increase the wages and, you know, make a job that used to be good paying but isn't anymore, will return it to like some semblance of a decent paying job. Here's your opportunity to do it. You know, especially for a guy like Ted Cruz, who, when the American analog to the Freedom Convoy rolled into D.C., they called themselves the People's Convoy, and, mm-hmm. you know, they had somewhat similar aims. Ted Cruz, like, went out of his way to go and meet up with those guys, and he, like, took a tour around in a big truck and filmed it. And, you know, there was another guy, Ron Johnson, I think, from some guy from Wisconsin, met with the People's Convoy folks. And so it's like, okay, Ted, well, here's something to help the people you just used for your photo op and that you said you ostensibly support. Just vote yes on the bill.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Just vote yes, because all they need is two or three people, and then it gets passed. Because, I mean, the Senate split, like, what, 51-49 or something, or 50-50? I can't remember. It's really tight.
Yeah.
So all they need is three or four Republicans to say yes. Boom, it's done. Now, there are some people who have said to me that it's within the realm of likelihood that they'll vote no just purely out of politics and out of spite, right? Because, you know, Mitch McConnell cannot allow the Democrats to have a win, even if the legislation in question is actually good.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's how, like, you know, vindictive and fucking stupid these people are. And I wouldn't put it past McConnell or whoever is in charge of the Senate or whatever to basically tell everybody, no, just don't vote yes on this, regardless of how good it will be for your constituents, especially given that, like, you know, most truckers lean conservative, and a lot of them would have voted for the Republicans, and a lot of them are like Trump fans and all the rest of it. But, like, you know, we can't give the Democrats a W. We can't do that, you know. Mm. We'll see how it cracks out, but, like, it would be really nice, you know, for people like Ted Cruz and like Josh Hawley, who's always going on about, you know, he sponsored some bill to, like, require American manufacturing for government contracts. And, you know, Marco Rubio is always going off about how his parents were working class and, like, you know, pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. And, you know, like, you know, put your money where your mouth is, motherfuckers, and just vote yes on this bill. Just do it.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly are bipartisan issues that the houses of legislature will vote together on. So hopefully this will be one of them.
Well, this doesn't involve bombing some country or, like, you know, handing out billions of dollars to Raytheon and, you know, Lockheed Martin and Halliburton and all that. So maybe not, you know.
Yeah, maybe this will be like a spite piece. But yeah, we'll see. It's difficult. The political structures are so closed off to, you know, you elect representatives and then pretty much the process is out of your hands. You know, it becomes a bit of a spectator sport. But yeah, I guess we'll be following it as it moves along the course. So maybe, like, switching gears a little bit, but not too much. I'm sure you've seen the news increasingly talking about how the economy is slipping into a recession.
You know, we're you know, when the government admits to 9.1% inflation, that it means it's like 15.
Yeah. I think there are, of course, these metrics that are derived from price signals, like the CPI is. But I always think like a really good way of getting a feel of whether or not we are slipping into recession is talking to the productive working class, which includes yourself. So what do you make of it? What's your view on the ground? Like, do you think that
my view on the ground, I can only speak to my own business. I don't feel like I'm qualified to speak about anything else about trucking, so I'm not going to. But I haul logs. I work for a small contractor with 3 trucks.
Yep.
We haul hardwood mostly to a couple of mills here in upstate New York. And the cost of fuel is basically killing us. My employer said that for April, May, and June, he basically made no money. His 64% of his overhead operating revenue was eaten up by the price of fuel. So he basically worked for nothing. And he mentioned to me and his other driver, there's a guy I work with named Roy, that, you know, if it wasn't for Roy and I having families to support, he probably would have just parked the trucks. So we were basically moving wood for nothing.
Yeah.
Because the cost of fuel just killed us. I mean, we did manage to extract a fuel surcharge out of the mill. But then, you know, the mill basically said like, that's it and no more. And now the mill we work for is now cutting back on the price of logs they're paying like to the loggers, like not to us for hauling it, but what they're actually paying for the wood. They're reducing that price because they just can't, the mill can no longer afford to keep operating with like the cost of everything. So like the inflation is really, it's hurting our customer. It's hurting us. And I didn't work today and it looks like I might not be working tomorrow because like everything just came to a screeching halt. Yeah. I think after 3 or 4 months of this, it's finally starting to catch up with us, and like there's just no wood. Like the log, one of the mills I haul into, they take secondary grade hardwood and they turn it into pallets for, you know, Walmart, Pepsi,
yep,
various companies around Syracuse. There's this particular mill is in Syracuse, and mm-hmm. last time I was there, their log yard was like 3/4 empty. And wow. The loader guy mentioned that a lot of the loggers that normally send them wood just can't operate. They can't run their equipment because of the price of fuel, and the price of the wood hasn't gone up enough to keep up with the inflated costs of parts for keeping their equipment going and chainsaws and this and that and all the rest of it. And they're just not getting wood.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're definitely seeing the costs of inflation and everything else that's happening in the economy right now.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear your perspective, actually. Yeah, because trucking is such a vital artery in the North American economic system. It links up different sections of the economy, and also it's plugged into the price to oil, which is probably the most important commodity in the United States, especially. And so, when things start breaking, you get the view from the different baseboards of the economy, I think, right away. So yeah, we'll see how things go. Like, I mean, the government and the Fed are still hoping to orchestrate some kind of softer landing without pushing the whole economy into recession. But I don't think the recession starts from the top. It starts from the bottom, as you've been describing. It starts from like a reduction in consumer demand, which is in turn caused by a loss of jobs and a loss of purchasing power, which is caused ultimately by the decline.
Well, a lot of this, like, you know, I'm gonna put my old libertarian hat back on. The last couple of years of just, you know, quantitative easing or printing money and the CARES Act and all the rest of that, there's so much extra money out there, they've devalued the money, right? Like, there's no getting around it. And you can only do that for so long. You know, we've been to this rodeo before, and the government just, they will do anything to try and wipe their hands of it and say it's not our fault. And, you know, it's not our fault that, like, you know, a couple of dozen diesel refineries have closed in the United States. It's not our fault that, like, our energy policy is not correctly, has disincentivized anyone from further producing fossil fuels. It's not our fault that like our utopian idealism of like this green energy future can't happen like the way we say it will. Like, we're not all gonna have electric vehicles tomorrow and a grid to support it. And oh, oops, actually we still need all this fossil energy around until we get there, but we've been demonizing it for so long that nobody wants to do it or produce it anymore because it costs too much money. So we're just not, and now we're stuck. And we'll just keep printing money to try and cover up for that and all our mistakes during COVID, and now the money is worthless, you know. And like, mm-hmm. I haven't gotten a raise to keep up with any of this, and I'm sure a lot of other people haven't either. So we're getting kicked in the nuts here from several different directions.
Well, that's for sure. And that's actually something I originally wanted to get you on to talk about before you got involved with this bill, which is climate change stuff. We did a show, me and Alex, on climate change with Ben Pyle a few months ago.
Yeah, I heard that. That was a great interview.
Thanks.
And by the way, hi, Alex. I'm sorry you couldn't make it tonight, sir. I'm really bummed out. I like Alex. His accent's awesome, and he's just a smart guy.
Yeah, that's the main things I like about him too. Is nice accent, smart guy. but an angle that we didn't really cover, we haven't really covered at all in any of the climate change episodes that we've done, is the labor angle and the effects of green ideology on labor. So I guess to start off with, like, so as we all know, especially you as a Canadian, you're aware of the mounting body of policy and politics constructed off of, you know, quote unquote, dealing with climate change. And you've observed some of this seep into the trucking industry. So can you tell us a bit about how green ideology affects the trucking industry?
Well, the whole idea of reducing emissions into the atmosphere, which is, you know, honorable enough goal in and of itself, how it's manifested, though, in regulating emissions on trucks has resulted in the trucking companies in a already hyper-competitive marketplace basically having to eat all the costs of this new emissions control equipment on the engines on their trucks. You know, so you've got like selective catalytic reduction systems, which require diesel exhaust fluid and all these new systems on the trucks. And the first iterations of those systems, and some of them are getting better, but a lot of them were very prone to breaking down, very expensive to maintain and fix. One company I worked for, in 18 months, they like spent $60,000 trying to correct the problems with an emissions control system on their truck, and then they just gave up and scrapped the truck because like nobody would buy it. The truck I'm driving right now for this logging contractor guy, it's been into Peterbilt twice now to have the diesel exhaust fluid SCR system fixed. One time it sat for a whole week, like 5 days. The truck was sitting because they were waiting for parts. And all of this cost is on us, right? Like, you know, it's coming out of our hides in order to satisfy, you know, some nebulous reduction in emissions, which is going to affect the climate by like, I don't know how many decimal points past the zero it is, but it's not anything that myself or anybody in the trucking business is ever going to notice other than the cost to us. Right. So like, you know, again, someone came up with the term with like vanity beliefs, and you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to get into the like veracity of climate change claims or whatever, but like the alarmism around it and the constant pushing of it by the media ends up creating policies and rules and regulations, which basically cost people, and it's not just anyone that works in like transportation or energy or whatever, because it ends up just costing everyone. Because now, you know, my last job before I was hauling logs was delivering propane, and the cost of home heating products has gone like through the roof, and everybody has to pay that, right? So it's not just like any one particularly like specific industry. Like, the climate alarmism has basically messed with markets, messed with regulations, messed with how the economy works, to such an extent that, like, the average working person is eating all of the costs of this, while the people banging on about it, I don't know. I guess maybe they're rich, maybe they're insulated from it, maybe they don't care. But, like, you know, when my propane bill to heat my house doubles, and some of that is in part due to reduced availability on the market of propane because a bunch of refineries closed because they've regulated the crap out of them because everyone's shitting their pants about, like, well, what's the next centigrade increase in global average temperature or something. Like, I'm paying for it, you're paying for it, we're all paying for it, but we're not getting anything extra. And it creates a lot of resentment, you know?
Yeah. As you've probably gathered from my comments on this podcast, I don't think the climate change narrative holds a lot of water. But I think, just as you're saying, like, all of these changes have various costs, whether they're whether it's financial on the back that ends up on the back of the consumer or companies and things like that. But it's not clear how they are linked up to the ultimate goal, the alleged goal of reducing the amount of climate change that's happening, right?
Okay, so here, I'm going to share a couple of anecdotes for you, okay?
Sure, yeah.
I don't want it to sound like I'm just whining.
You know.
I want your listeners to have some concrete examples of how various regulations actually are run counter to what the climate people want. So in 2009... my last year running on the ice roads in the Northwest Territories, the company I used to work for on the ice, my last year I worked for an independent contractor with a group out of Edmonton, and then the people I worked for previously in Yellowknife got bought by another company, and then this other company sent up all these, like, new, they were like a joint venture between Mack and Volvo. It's like some kind of truck called a Pentagon, and they had all the latest emissions control equipment on those trucks, but they wouldn't work in the cold, and those trucks froze up and had to get towed back to Yellowknife constantly to get fixed. And then the solution they found in order to get them to run properly was to run them at very high RPMs, and at lower gearing in order to keep the temperature up in the motors. So here's me in my 1993 Peterbilt with a mechanical 4 1/4 cat pulling the exact same load as a brand new 2009 Mack, and we would both go to the mine from Yellowknife to, say, Diavik or BHP Diamonds and drop off our loads of fuel, and I would burn to Diavik and back to Yellowknife, I would burn between 580 and 620 liters a trip, and these brand new trucks with the emission control systems on them that wouldn't work properly were burning between 800 and 1100 liters per trip. Right. So, yeah. How's this helping? Right.
Yeah.
the truck my dad drove for this company in Ontario, if you are in the trucking business, you hear about, like, guys turning their DEF systems off, which is illegal, and you can get, like, fined into oblivion if you get caught.
Yeah.
But on some of those systems, you know, my dad and the company my dad worked for, they actually did an experiment where they had a guy run with my dad. My dad's truck, the emission control system was not tampered with, not turned off. And then another truck with the system turned off was sent with my dad. They hauled the exact same load. They went to the exact same place, same mileage, same terrain, same everything. And they ran together for a week. And at the end of that week, my dad's truck had burned an extra 400 liters more than the other truck that had the emissions system turned off. Right. And then the emissions system themselves. So there's a used truck market, right? So, like, trucking companies in the US and Canada will keep a truck for, you know, 3 to 5, maybe 7 years. And then they'll sell it. And a lot of those trucks end up in the international market. They'll go to Africa. They'll go to Central America. They'll go to Asia. They go all over the place. Right. And then they'll continue working somewhere else, pumping their emissions into the same atmosphere. What happens when those trucks get to the new countries they operate in? The people that bought them immediately turn the emission control systems off and have the system deleted out of the computer that runs the motor because it costs them too much money to repair the damn things and they can't get the parts and it costs more money and fuel. So they just turn them off.
Yeah.
So, like, we're doing all this stuff And basically what these regulations are doing are punching truckers in North America in the dick and making them make less money. And then eventually these trucks, either the guys in North America will delete them themselves, or they end up in another country where that's the first thing that happens to them.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or they actually, you know, they're getting better. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, some of the companies have gotten better. You know, Mack got a motor, an MP8 that seems to work pretty well. The new Cummins Century Series engine seems to do better with its SCR system. So it's not to say that they're not improving, but since 2007, when these regulations were put on the trucking business, they ran counter to everything that was claimed that they were going to do.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous, because I find that these policies, like you're describing, they'll look at one small portion of an entire system, and they don't consider the secondary, tertiary effects. It's much like the COVID-19 protocols that we had in place. Like, they don't consider the network effects. They don't consider anything beyond like one or two metrics that they're trying to measure. I think it's a result of bureaucratization of science, and definitely of politics. It really narrows people's views, and they don't like it. Maybe it makes sense in some narrow, from some narrow perspective, to modify trucks in the way that you're describing, but in a global sense, which is allegedly the type of problem this climate change issue is, it makes no sense.
Yeah, no, and then you know, people have to remember what incentives are, right? And like I said, the cost of these systems is being borne by the operators, right? In a particular industry with really tight profit margins, it's hard to pass that cost on to the consumer. You know, like in business, everyone, you know, the government likes to say, well, this new regulation or this new requirement or whatever, yes, we understand it's going to cost your business more money. Well, you just have to add it to your bottom line and pass it on to the consumer, and we'll all absorb it. Well, it doesn't always work like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so you've mentioned that you think that reducing the amount of CO2 emissions in trucks is, while it's being approached in a very silly way, it is ultimately a noble goal. So are you worried about climate change? How about your coworkers? Like, I know a lot of professionals are deathly worried about climate change. I have, you know, professional friends who don't want to have kids or something because of climate change.
Well, I mean, I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, so I'm a little bit, I can't speak for other people. I'll tell you that the two guys I work with immediately next to me, my employer and this other driver I follow around all the time, not worried at all. My employer is the kind of guy that would, you know, refer to climate alarmists as libtards. you know, he just sees his business losing money constantly because of this, and he's not into it. My more nuanced view than his is that I don't see how climate alarmism helps anything.
Yeah. Right?
And like, it's being used, climate alarmism is being used. It's so blatantly obvious that like, it's being used to scare the shit out of people and get them to accept a reduced standard of living, and to get them to accept the government imposing more things on their lives, and, you know, various giveaways to various industries who are going to claim to help it. And it's turning into like an entire complex. I don't even know if I really buy the climate change narrative as such. Like, you know, what is it? Is anthropogenic global warming, whatever human caused. I just don't like, I don't know enough about it to have an opinion either way on like, quote unquote, the science. And I mean, you know, scientism and as a new religion being hijacked by all these people, that's a completely another discussion. But to get to your question, no, we are not worried at all. No. Don't give a fuck.
It's hard to worry about something that is, even if you do think that it is a real issue, it's like, if people have problems like in their direct daily life, like things that they have to take care of today, next week, you know, like this is something, I mean, listen, the timelines get shorter and shorter every time they do.
Can I interrupt you just a minute? When I say I don't care about it, the reason I don't care is because I have seen what the policies do.
Yes.
I have seen, it's not that I don't necessarily quote unquote believe in climate change, right? That's another question. I'm just looking at this purely from like the economics of it and how the regulations work and who's benefiting. And it ain't me and it ain't us. It isn't the working class. And, you know, something isn't right. You know, it just doesn't smell right. And like, from my view, there's things that the government could be doing to promote efficiency that would reduce carbon emissions by untold numbers of millions of tons by increasing the efficiency of trucking fleets, you know, having trucks carry more weight per load, maybe expanding the use of multi-trailer vehicles or multi-combination trucks. There's things they do to make the system more efficient and reduce emissions, and they don't do them. They rely on the tech bros to put fancy shit on existing equipment, and they don't change the base level efficiency of the trucking fleet in total. And I think that's the tell, that this isn't about what they say it is, because there's all kinds of stuff they could do that wouldn't cost very much money, wouldn't really cost the taxpayer, wouldn't really cost the working class fucking anything, and they don't do those things.
To me, I think a lot of these quote-unquote solutions, technology solutions especially, are just giveaways to various favored groups. Like, for example, in Canada, tons of government money is given to oil and gas companies to green their operations, like, for example, start carbon capture technologies or install them, which are actually completely unproven. There's no evidence they actually do. They actually work for their intended purpose. But, you know, it's millions of dollars that is funneled to the oil and gas industry in Canada, which is a very profitable industry. Like, I'm not against that industry. I think obviously we all need oil and gas, but it's just like, it doesn't, like, it just seems to me like it's a tax money giveaway to just a favored group the government likes. Even though, like, our current government talks a lot against the oil and gas industry, it is actually quite favored by the Canadian government in a lot of ways. Maybe kind of working off of that question and what I just said. So it seems like, you know, with Ukraine and with the inflation and with, you know, especially with increasing gas prices, it seems like governments are kind of inching away from their zero carbon promises. Like, so Biden has done so far 2 trips to the Middle East to try to get some.
Layla, I'm gonna do something very rude. I'm going to ask a woman her age. How old are you?
There's no way I'm giving my age on this podcast.
Okay,
I'm in my early 30s. Very early.
Okay. All right. That's fair. I'm rude and I'm very
impressed. No, it's not rude. I'm just kidding.
But yeah. From my perspective, I'm 43. I've been an aware, politically aware adult since the late 1990s.
Okay.
Right? And I've watched as the United States government has played footsie with the Saudis since forever.
Yeah.
And wars in Iraq and against Afghanistan, and then like trying to like overthrow the government in Venezuela. And very quietly, Kamala Harris was like going to Venezuela to like try and get them to up their production. And now Joe Biden is coming cap in hand to the Saudis. Please, please, please up your production. So it's like, okay, cool. So we can have, you know, dirty oil from Venezuela, because the oil reserves in Venezuela are like the like lowest grade oil that need the most work to actually make them into usable energy products on Earth, right? They've got lots of it, but it's like shit grade oil. And then we have the Saudis, who basically, you know, that's what The Handmaid's Tale is about, right? Like all these people running around in the red outfits. It's like, okay, right, that's fine. Go live in Riyadh or something. Go take your dumb bullshit and apply it to where it actually matters. And we have Biden going over there begging those guys for more oil. And it's like, well, there's tons of it in Canada and there's tons in the U.S. Why is it that, like, we can go and bug dirty oil producers to increase your production, but they won't allow it here? Right.
I think there's a lot of sense in what you're saying. Biden has been berating the domestic oil industry for not producing enough. even though I think that's an unfair accusation. I think the oil industry has been producing as much as its capacity has allows it to do. But I mean, there's other issues around the way it's been investing money over the last few years. But in any case, it does seem as at least lately, within the last, you know, 5-6 months, it seems like the policies and the promises, like more of the extreme ones around green ideology, are being retrenched a little bit. So, for instance, like Biden accusing domestic oil industry for not producing enough, and just, you know, enjoying record high profits, for example, like that's kind of counter his green, you know, kind of policy package that he had.
Well, I mean, they canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, and I mean, this isn't all necessarily Biden's fault, you know, like there's, you know, it's more like the deep bureaucratic state. But like, you know, there's been a series of refinery and upgrader closures across the U.S. for like over a decade now, and like that's the capacity crunch. We don't have the ability to upgrade the stuff anymore, or at least to the volumes that the market still requires to function at prices consumers are used to, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, you know, it's all good to like, you know, beg the Saudis or Venezuela for more oil. How about you just cut out some of the bureaucracy and nonsense impeding American production from happening? You know, like, it's within your power. You're the president. Like, just be like, hey, we're going to have some meetings and we're going to, like, figure this out and cut some of this dumb shit out of the way. And they don't.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's hard to take these people seriously when they do stuff like that. And I mean, especially, you know, from a class perspective, like, you know, if you're a working class person here in America, like, what good is it to you to have to buy foreign oil when, like, you could be helping other people in your own country have jobs producing the same thing, and, like, thereby, you know, increasing the wage floor and, like, just increasing the general amount of money circulating here? And, you know, it's so hard to accept the leadership we're being shown right now by these people when they're doing things that are clearly antagonistic to the people they're supposed to be representing and working for.
It seems to me like my read of the situation with regards to domestic oil production, both in the United States and Canada, is that there's been like, you know, 30, 40 plus years of this buildup around, you know, green ideology that has built up, in fact, civil society organizations and various bureaucratic organizations within government or adjacent to government. And so they have their own momentum, and they've developed a set of their own interests with regards to this problem. And they have their own set of things they want to see happen. So I think that you see like these very contradictory type of policies and moves, wherein, you know, you have Biden, for instance, giving out record level permits to drill on existing leases on federal land, but at the same time he also did implement a moratorium on granting new leases. So it's a little bit of a weird, and you know, for example, threatening to put a cap on Russian hydrocarbons, a price cap, which would inevitably have the result of reducing supply, is contradictory to, like, you know, his stated goal of, or his probably his very sincere desire to reduce gas prices domestically. So there's a lot of like contradictory behavior and policies and stuff that are being deployed. But I guess with regards to the trucking industry, like, have you seen that because of the high gas prices, like, are those in the trucking industry that were perhaps more keen on implementing like green solutions, are they starting to lose interest at this point too? Maybe shifting a little bit with the way they talk about this issue.
Can you clarify that question a little bit for me? Like, what do you mean by implementing green, like within the trucking business themselves?
Yeah. So if there was any like thought leaders or any business leaders that were, you know,
well, they're still singing from the same tune, and you know, there's still people trying to make electric trucks, and I mean, all of that stuff is still happening.
Yeah.
You know, and they, you know, there are people who are trying to like be as efficient as they can with fuel, but like, you know, at the same time as this fuel price crunch has hit, like, the demand for like the for freight right now is like dropped off quite considerably. Like the spot market's taking a beating and rates are going down. So,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of guys washing out. There's been, you know, a friend of mine named Rachel Premack writes on this, and she calls it like the great trucker purge of 2022. Like lots of new entrants to the industry are now leaving. You know, in general, the tech bros are still going to tech bro. The thought leaders are still going to thought terminate with their cliches. You know, all this stuff is going to keep moving. The question is, you know, like, again, from my own perspective, you know, at the bottom of the heap here, just trying to haul some logs and raise my kids, like, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. are any of you people going to do something to, like, materially benefit me and my fellows? And I don't see it.
Yeah, you know, exactly. That's what it really comes down to. And it's funny because it's a lot of this kind of rhetorical stuff happens at a high level, and people who are most affected by it all don't get any say. They don't get to, like, you know, suggest solutions. You were, before this interview, you were talking to me about this really interesting thing where you had a relative who had thought about a really, was kind of a trained or had interest in engineering and had thought about this really creative, interesting way of reducing the amount of gas being used by trucks, but he couldn't like get it implemented because I couldn't remember the exact reason, but it sounded like he just didn't have like the specific, this weird like arbitrary thing that was required by.
So there's a really interesting dude out in BC. His name's Chase something. I can't remember any. He's trying to like build a step between here and the green utopian future in the form of a logging truck that's like a diesel electric generator. So it's got like regenerative braking, a battery system, and then like a small diesel engine that like runs a generator that powers everything when they don't have the regenerative energy has been depleted of the batteries. It's an interesting concept. And I had recommended a video on this to my brother-in-law, who's kind of in, you know, green engineering, so to speak, and building science and whatnot. And he's fully on board with a lot of the green utopianism, and he was kind of dismissive of it. And I think it was because like there was still a diesel engine involved, and it's like, you need a backup for when you don't have enough, you know, potential energy stored from the gravity from going down hills, and like, you know, like the stuff all has to work. And then he had like the balls to say, well, this doesn't comport with physics. And I'm like, no, not having an engine backup in order for it to work when there's no hills to go down does not comport with physics. It's just like the mentality of some of these people, they don't, you know, I think like the green utopianism and like this total, you know, green electric future, they just they don't realize or don't want to see that like that's a fair enough goal to have. But between here and there, you have to take steps and you have to like do things gradually in order to get there because technology is expensive. You know, grid capacity isn't where it should be. We don't have the generating capacity. A lot of this stuff is, again, really expensive. And what happens when it doesn't work? Like you need backup. And there was something about his response to me that like belied a utopian vision that's a little bit slightly unmoored from reality.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's very common. Like in Canada, as you know, the leader of the NDP, Jagmeet Singh, for a while he was on this this thing where he wanted to promote like bike lanes. Like he was like, yes, bike lanes. Like this is the solution to gas emissions from cars if everyone would just bike. It's just like, you know, when you look at the stats, like a very small percentage of people regularly bike anywhere, and those
even people that live in urban areas, small percentage.
Yeah, it's a very small, exactly. It's just that the cities that we have in Canada and the United States are not built for biking. We have long winters in the state of New York included. It's biking isn't like a viable solution for people with families, people with disabilities, people who are older, things like that. So it really is a utopian, it's utopianism. And I mean, like this is another reason why I doubt the sincerity or whatever of these catastrophic predictions is that like these are not actual solutions. Like if this was a real emergency, you would expect real solutions to be at least suggested, but these things are just fantasy. They're literally just fantasy. There's no connection.
Yeah. Oh, I think what happens is that the utopianism just narrows their vision, and I think part of this is the demonization of just fossil fuels in general. It's like, oh, that's icky, and like if any of that is part of the solution, then it doesn't count. You know, there was a really interesting interview on. Oh man, what's the name of that big normie podcast? It's called Odd Lots, I think. And they spoke with a guy who's a sort of petroleum engineer dude from Calgary, and he gave a really interesting breakdown on like how the energy industry is actually like really short on people, and they can't get people to go into like certain parts of like engineering education. Towards working in that because strictly because of demonization, everybody wants to be like doing the bright new shiny electric object. And there's like some course at the University of Calgary that produces, you know, petroleum engineers or something. And there's like only one person taking it.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to have to turn things around eventually. They're going to have to change their tune entirely eventually. I think like it's a bit, it's going to be getting to a point where, I mean, it's gone to a point where there is real economic damage on a broad level because of the lack of oil supply. They're going to have to do something about it. I don't think they're gonna, my guess is that one day we're going to wake up and then suddenly climate change will have been resolved or no longer of a big interest, much like COVID-19. We just woke up one day and it was like, hooray, pandemic over. We're all good now.
Everything is over. Oh, man. We could do another show on the reckoning that needs to happen, and especially with the people that are going to say it's all over now. It's cool. You resume what you were doing before. Who would have been the loudest to tell us the opposite only a few months ago, or still now?
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. We could do another show on that. So maybe to finish off, you did mention something which. Just as the last question I had for you, and then we can wrap up the show on this note. So a few months ago, there was a lot of talk about supply chain issues, but you just mentioned a couple minutes ago that freight prices were down, which is something I've been watching quite closely as well. So what do you feel like? Do you think that the supply chain issues, I know they're still bad, things are still tight, but do you think they are improving?
I actually don't know. I don't know that they are. I don't know. Just watching what's happening with boats and the rails. There was supposed to be a rail strike here in the U.S. that like
yes.
Biden managed to like he did some move that's going to postpone it. The rail workers are kind of getting screwed by a lot of the railways, and then the rails have their own capacity issues. And like I don't know. I mean maybe. Maybe there's been like a little lull. Maybe like things, you know, it's summertime, kids aren't in school, people are kind of enjoying themselves. Maybe nobody's paying attention, but something tells me like the supply chain stuff is nowhere near being contended with. Like it's not done yet.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's not done yet. Like the wait times and stuff are still pretty high. But I think that it is interesting that freight prices and also the stock prices of the major supply chain companies that exist. Have been going down, but yeah, I think things are still bad enough to not like to still like to, so that the supply chain issues are still very noticeable and causing some latent inflationary pressures, it seems like.
Yes.
So I know that this is you were kicked off of Twitter, sadly for all of us. Do you want to share with us your a better place to find you and learn more about everything that you're working on?
Yeah, I'll hopefully be publishing one or two pieces through your friends at Compact Mag.
Later oh, great!
This summer.
Oh, fantastic!
They've commissioned me to write two things.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be maybe writing something for American Affairs that's going to come out in January on a book. Actually, you know, this will be of interest to you. I've been recently alerted to a academic here in the U.S. who's written a study basically on what everything I've talked about previously about surveillance technology imposed on truckers and what that has to say about like the surveilling the rest of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
This book's going to be published in December, and I've got an advanced copy of it, and I'll be doing a review of it from the perspective of somebody that's been subject to all this surveillance garbage. So that should be interesting. As far as Twitter, yeah, I mean, I have an alt. People who know me can find me. you have to have an alt, and then the game, the cat and mouse game carries on. I've launched yet more suspension appeals. Who knows? You'll just pay attention to Red Star Radio, and whenever I have something, I'll send it to you, and you can ship it out there.
Yeah, we'll definitely have you back on when you publish all these pieces. I'm really excited to hear you've got so many on the way. This is great.
Yeah, well, I mean, one's, like I say, is going to be a review of this sort of scholarly academic work on the effects of surveilling truckers.
Mm.
Another one is going to be on my view of the autonomous truck revolution coming down the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And also like a bit of a discussion of Matthew Crawford's book, Why We Drive.
Mm.
And then the other one, which just entered the editing process, is going to be an expansion on the one I did for Newsweek, specifically about Rep Levin's bill and stuff going on with the trucking business. So
yeah,
we'll see where it all goes.
Yeah, that autonomous trucking trend will be really interesting. Like artificial intelligence is a kind of a perennial topic that comes up. So it'll be interesting to see what you think. Is it real? Is it a big deal? Is it going to take over our jobs? Things like that. So we'll see.
Caltrops, belt spikes, hillbillies with guns, and broken down semis throughout the backcountry, emptied of all of their freight. Yeah, that's what I foresee. But anyway,
I don't think. Yeah, I'm doubtful. But yeah, but maybe it'll happen in a few companies, and such a disaster will ensue, and then people will rethink. Like maybe this artificial intelligence isn't as smart as we thought. But yeah, we'll see.
Can I wrap the show up with a quote from an old friend of mine?
Absolutely.
This gentleman hasn't spoken with me in months. I think COVIDianism got to him and his wife. I don't know, but anyway, I hope he's okay. But he sent me a text one time. We were discussing automation and artificial intelligence, and I'm going to quote my friend.
Yeah.
Quote. Artificial intelligence is called artificial intelligence because it's fucking fake. It's right there in the name, and the fact that nobody realizes this proves the profound autism of the entire project. End quote.
It's a great quote.
Artificial, right? It's fake. It's not real.
Yeah, it's like you can make intelligence. It's called having kids. Like that's the only way you can like create intelligence. Like you don't, you know, you can't make human intelligence in a computer. Anyways, but yeah, Gord, thank you so much for coming back on. You know, you're really busy, but yeah, hopefully we'll be able to get you on in the future as you publish these pieces. I guess we'll catch up with you later next time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Bummer Alexander couldn't make it. Cheers, mate. Hope to talk to you next time. And thanks for listening. I'm completely amazed that anybody cares what I have to say about anything. And thanks again for having me on.
Well, clearly a lot of people care, so I don't think you should be so amazed. But thank you for coming on.
No sweat. Thanks, Layla.
Bye.